This is Audible.
The Bully Pulpit. Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. By Doris Kearns Goodwin.
Chapter 7. The Creation of McClure's. In the mid-1890s, the genteel world of patrician reformers and civil service enthusiasts that Taft and Roosevelt initially typified had begun a seismic shift. Widespread discontent with the industrial order, building for over a decade, threatened now to flare into open revolution. Growth of colossal corporations in the aftermath of the Civil War had produced immense consolidated wealth for business owners, but the lives of the working people, Western farmers and Eastern factory workers alike, had become increasingly difficult. "We plow new fields, we open new mines, we found new cities," Roosevelt's mayoral rival Henry George observed. "We girdle the land with iron roads and lace the air with telegraph wires. We add knowledge to knowledge and utilize invention after invention." Yet, despite such vaunted progress, he declared, "it becomes no easier for the masses of our people to make a living. On the contrary, it is becoming harder." The captains of industry, George acknowledged, had fueled unprecedented innovations. The steamship taking the place of the sailing vessel, the railroad train of the wagon, the reaping machine of the scythe. "To confirm the positive changes wrought by the Industrial Revolution," he continued, "one need only visit the great workshops where boots and shoes are turned out by the case with less labor than the old-fashioned cobbler could have put on a sole. The factories where, under the eye of a girl, cotton becomes cloth faster than hundreds of stalwart weavers could have turned it out with their hand looms." With this transfiguring mechanization and the development of mass production, however, the gulf between the employed and the employer is growing wider. Social contrasts are becoming sharper. As liveried carriages appear, so do barefooted children. Far from heralding an age of plenty, these wondrous savings of time and labor served only to diminish the ability of many Americans to procure the goods they needed to sustain their families. So long as the frontier remained open, restless Americans could escape hardship by moving west, lured by promises of free land and equal opportunity. By the 1890s, this option had withered. As Frederick Jackson Turner observed in a seminal paper delivered during the American Historical Association meeting in Chicago, the frontier had closed, and a distinctive phase of American history had, thereby, come to an end. A mood of rebellion began to spread among the laboring class. The late 80s and 90s witnessed an unprecedented number of violent strikes in the nation's factories, mines, and railroads. The combination of meager wages for 12-hour working days in unsafe, unsanitary conditions had spurred millions of workers to join unions. It was a time of strikes and riots, pitting troops against desperate workers, historian Frank Latham observed, of tense meetings where businessmen talked fearfully of a coming revolution. In the year 1886 alone, more than 600,000 workers walked out on strike, disrupting thousands of businesses and railroad lines for weeks at a time. At the McCormick Reaper plant in Chicago, police were called in to break up a confrontation between strikers and scabs. In the brutal clash, four workers were killed. On May 4th, a group of anarchists gathered in Chicago's Haymarket Square to protest the police action. The peaceful demonstration turned violent when police ordered the protesters to disperse. A bomb thrown into the police formation killed eight policemen and four protesters and wounded more than 70 others. Although police never determined who threw the bomb, they promptly arrested eight anarchists, several of whom had not even attended the demonstration. At their trial, the judge ruled that the anarchists' belief in violence made them as guilty as the murderous bomb thrower. Four were put to death by hanging, the others sentenced to jail. Citing an unprecedented miscarriage of justice, Illinois Governor John Peter Altgeld pardoned the remaining prisoners. History has vindicated Altgeld, but the pardon was widely condemned at the time. News of the Haymarket riot reached Roosevelt at his ranch in Medora. Drawing no distinction between the strikers and the anarchist protesters, Roosevelt railed against the breakdown of law and order. "My men here are hard-working laboring men who work longer hours for no greater wages than many of the strikers, but they are Americans through and through," he told Bammy. "I believe nothing would give them greater pleasure than a chance with their rifles at one of the mobs. When we get the papers, especially in relation to the dynamite business, they become more furiously angry and excited than I do. I wish I had them with me and a fair show at 10 times our number of rioters. My men shoot well and fear very little." While some Union supporters regarded the condemned anarchists as heroes, Roosevelt judged them the foulest of criminals, the men whose crimes take the form of assassination. He denounced Governor Altgeld, along with all those who followed Leo Tolstoy's collectivist longings, Edward Bellamy's utopian socialism, and Henry George's wild and illogical doctrines. Men who mistakenly believed that at this stage of the world's progress it is possible to make everyone happy by an immense social revolution, just as other enthusiasts of similar mental caliber believe in the possibility of constructing a perpetual motion machine. In 1893, the most serious depression the nation had yet experienced settled over the land. The downturn began when the railroads, having borrowed heavily from banks, rashly expanded operations beyond current demand. More than 70 overbuilt railroads fell into bankruptcy, compromising banks unable to recoup their loans. Scrambling to shore up capital, these institutions called in the loans of all their borrowers. Small businesses and heavily mortgaged farmers, unable to cover their notes, followed railroads into bankruptcy. As the economic situation deteriorated, frightened depositors rushed to withdraw funds, and hundreds of insolvent banks were forced to close their doors. Within 12 months, more than 4 million jobs had been lost. At the nadir of this collapse, nearly 1 in 4 workers was unemployed. Jobless men begged for food. Homeless families slept on streets. Farmers burned their crops rather than send them to market at a loss. Millions feared that in the wreckage of the Gilded Age, democracy itself would crumble. Amid such pangs of rampant anxiety and latent insurrection, McClure's Magazine was born. This acclaimed muckraking journal would play a signal role in rousing the country to the need for political and economic reform, animating the progressive movement with which Theodore Roosevelt's name would forever be linked. Descriptions of 36-year-old Samuel S. McClure, the magazine's founder, bear an uncanny resemblance to accounts of Theodore Roosevelt himself. McClure was termed a genius, with a highly creative mind and a great deal of excitable energy. He impressed all who knew him as a prodigious character, a vibrant, eager, indomitable personality that electrified even the experienced and the cynical. His frenetic style, however, made him often appear a bundle of tensions, keyed up, impetuous, impatient, impulsive. While Roosevelt's tumultuous energy elicited comparison to that force and marvel of nature, Niagara Falls, McClure, ever threatening to erupt in a stream of words, was likened to a volcano. Indeed, McClure cut such a compelling figure that novelists as varied as Robert Louis Stevenson, Willa Cather, Upton Sinclair, William Dean Howells, and Alice Hegan Rice incorporated him as a character in their fiction. McClure was capable of wild bursts of creative productivity, episodes during which his mind tumbled from one idea to the next while he prowled the room like a caged lion. Rudyard Kipling later recalled that his first conversation with McClure lasted some 12, or it may have been 17, hours. Euphoria, however, was often punctuated by periods of exhaustion and depression when he could not bring himself to eat, sleep, or concentrate. For months at a time, he was forced into sanitariums where he was kept in total isolation on continuous bed rest. Born the same year as Taft on a struggling farm in County Antrim, Northern Ireland, McClure faced obstacles unimaginable to Roosevelt or Taft. The first of four sons, he was raised in a stone house with a dirt floor and a straw-covered roof. His father Thomas was a rough carpenter. His mother Elizabeth worked the fields of their farm. While the coddled childhoods enjoyed by Roosevelt and Taft were calculated to launch them on the road to achievement, the pain and penury of McClure's early life make his convoluted journey to success more unexpected and striking. Even as a toddler, Sam displayed unusual curiosity, a fierce precocity that convinced his parents to send him to school when he was only 4 years of age. "That was the first important event in my life," he later wrote. "It was then that I first felt myself a human entity." Teachers recognized his astonishing aptitude and were soon furnishing material suited for boys twice his age. "For a long while," he recalled, "I was convinced that long division was the most exciting exercise a boy could find." Several times each year, a large box of new books was delivered to his school. For a child whose family possessed a scant 3 volumes, the Bible, Pilgrim's Progress, and Fox's Book of Martyrs, the experience of opening those boxes and looking into the fresh books that still had the smell of the press was about the most delightful thing that happened during the year. Weekends often found him depressed. The excitement of his studies seemed to die down the moment he returned home. Sam was 7 when his father fell through an open ship's deck where he worked and suffered a fatal head injury. His death left the family destitute, bereft of the small wages his carpentry work had provided. Sam began for the first time to be conscious of the pressure of poverty. His mother returned temporarily to her father's home as the family debated how to divide the boys among relatives. Determined to keep her sons together, Elizabeth used her remaining funds to purchase steerage passage across the Atlantic. From Quebec, she shepherded her children to Indiana, where 2 of her brothers and a married sister with 6 children had settled. For a time, she stayed with her sister, but the home proved too small to accommodate 4 additional children. In desperation, she moved with her boys into an empty room of a commercial building undergoing repairs. Before long, the owner evicted them. Twice more they were forced to move until, finally, she found a home for her children by marrying a struggling local farmer, Thomas Simpson. Sam and his brothers spent so many hours toiling from planting until harvest on his stepfather's farm that they could attend school only during the winter months. Furthermore, the county school was unable to accommodate Sam's searching intellect. Hearing of a kind of arithmetic in which letters were used instead of figures, the avid pupil asked his teacher to tutor him in algebra. The teacher had never studied it and had no textbook. The years passed slowly for Sam until at 14 he learned of a new high school opened in Valparaiso. Straight away, his mother decided that to have a chance in life, he must venture out on his own. If he could find work to pay for room and board, Sam had her blessing to leave. He departed that very day with $1 in his pocket. Learning that Dr. Levi Cass was Valparaiso's wealthiest citizen, Sam knocked on his door and inquired if he could exchange work for room and board. Cass accepted the enterprising young man, but his terms were not especially generous. In return for food and a basement room, Sam was expected to build up the fires before dawn, feed the livestock, and do the household laundry. Once the school was over, a second round of arduous chores left him only a few hours late in the evening to study. In his cellar room, he recalled, "I used to waken up in the night and cry from the sense of my loss." It was in these straitened circumstances that Sam initially suffered attacks of restlessness, when he simply had to run away for a day, for a half day, for 2 days, a compulsion he seemed to have no control over. "Indeed," he acknowledged 40 years later, "I have had to reckon with it all my life." Sam persevered in his schooling for 2 years, until his stepfather's death from typhoid fever forced his return home to help his mother manage the farm. Sam and his brothers worked the farm well, producing a profit for the first time in years. Still, his mother wanted her eldest son to continue his education. Her brother Joseph Gaston was studying at Knox College in Galesburg, Illinois, about 200 miles away. In September of 1874, as Taft traveled east to Yale, McClure headed west to Galesburg. Upon his arrival, he was informed that his prior fragmentary schooling would require the completion of 3 full years at Knox Academy before he could even begin college. The news did not deter him. "I was 17," he recalled, "and it was a 7 years job that I was starting upon, with 15 cents in my pocket." Finally realizing the opportunity to pursue a serious education, he felt complete self-reliance. Once again, he had to work hard for room and board, but managed to keep up with his studies, moving toward the day when he would become a freshman at the college. At 17, a shock of blonde hair over his forehead and blue eyes bright and clear, the painfully thin Sam had reached his full height of 5 feet 6 inches. One classmate remarked that he had never seen so much enthusiasm in life in such a small carcass. All his subjects interested him, Greek and mathematics most of all. "Everything went well with me until Friday night," he recalled, "when the blank stretch of the weekend rendered him disconsolate. Without the focal point of classes, he felt lonely and isolated." During his second preparatory year, Sam fell in love with 18-year-old Harriet Hurd, considered by many the most beautiful and gifted girl in town. The willowy, blue-eyed daughter of Knox College's star professor Albert Hurd, Hattie, as she was called, was then a sophomore in the college. A brilliant student, she would graduate at the top of her class with the highest academic record ever obtained at Knox. "Don't cry for the moon," the kindly wife of the town's minister told Sam. Hattie had been her father's assistant since childhood, working by his side as he gathered geological specimens and prepared materials for his classes in science, religion, and Latin. Professor Hurd, a graduate of Middlebury College, had studied under Louis Agassiz at Harvard before embarking on a long and distinguished career at Knox. A commanding figure in Hattie's life, Professor Hurd adamantly opposed his daughter's relationship with an impoverished immigrant. The professor's opposition seemed to embolden rather than discourage Sam. "My feeling for her," he later recalled, "became a despairing obsession, as fixed as my longing to get an education had been." From the start, Hattie was drawn to Sam's peculiar intensity. After a series of furtive meetings and a surreptitious exchange of romantic letters, she agreed to a secret engagement. Torn between her father's implacable disapproval and her adoration for Sam, she repeatedly broke the engagement, only to realize that she couldn't resist the magnetism of Sam's personality. When she graduated from Knox and prepared for graduate school in Canada, however, her father forbade Hattie to disclose her destination to Sam. Secrecy was the price for her continued education. "You mustn't write to me or expect to hear from me as long as I am dependent on my father," she told Sam. "If I should bring his displeasure on me, it would kill me. Oh, Sam, it is very hard to bear." For nearly 4 years, all communication in this odd and fervent relationship ceased. Following her departure, Sam immersed himself in his studies, eventually graduating second in his college class. More importantly, he developed lifelong friendships with 2 classmates, John Phillips and Albert Brady, that one day would be instrumental to the success of McClure's magazine. Sam was closest to John Phillips, the quiet, steady, and intellectual son of a respected local physician and a relative of abolitionist Wendell Phillips. Phillips, McClure proudly noted, was easily the best-read student in the college, a boy with a great natural aptitude for letters. At Phillips' house, McClure first encountered a copy of Scribner's, the sophisticated literary magazine that would soon become the Century. Returning numerous times to his friend's home, he was thrilled to read the new serialized novel by William Dean Howells, A Modern Instance, from start to finish. Sam McClure's enterprising spirit and unique knack for finding partners with complementary abilities was already evident. In the summer between his junior and senior years, McClure canvassed the Great Lakes region, peddling microscopes with Brady, the son of the editor of the Davenport, Iowa Daily Times. Enabled by Brady's shrewdness, the two Knox students bought microscopes wholesale at $25 each and turned them into profit. McClure would later credit his experience of traveling through villages and knocking on doors with fostering a close acquaintance with the people of the small towns and the farming communities, the people who afterward bought McClure's magazine. In his senior year, McClure was chosen editor-in-chief of the student newspaper. His unconventional working style both troubled and amazed his colleagues on the paper. "He works by fits and starts," a fellow student noted. "Weeks, almost months go by, and he does no work to amount to anything, and then crowds all into a few days and nights." With Phillips providing daily editorial support and Brady as the advertising virtuoso, however, the publication produced quality articles and successfully solicited an abundance of advertising from local businesses. In the years ahead, observed the journalist Ray Stanyard Baker, this same triumvirate would be responsible for the triumph of McClure's. While McClure provided the foundation work of creative genius, the magazine would never have realized its historic status without the insightful editing of Phillips and the business acumen of Albert Brady. The three together, Baker marveled, who had been friends since their college days, made the perfect publishing organization. After an absence of 4 years, Hattie returned briefly to Galesburg in 1881. She had completed her graduate training and was preparing to depart for Massachusetts, where she had accepted a teaching position at Abbott Academy in Andover. A chance encounter with Sam apparently summoned old feelings, and the young couple recommitted themselves to one another. "My present and future are completely changed," Sam told her. "My soul is filled with love and peace and joy." Although she soon left for Massachusetts, they revived their secret correspondence. Sam filled his letters with grandiose intentions, entertaining various careers as diplomat, philosopher, and writer-publisher. As the date of his June graduation approached, however, Hattie's letters stopped coming. Sensing that something was wrong, Sam consulted Phillips, who recommended that he head for Massachusetts the moment the graduation ceremonies ended. A letter from Hattie arrived just after Sam left Galesburg. "Mr. McClure," it formally declared, "I have come to the unalterable conclusion that I have not and never can have any respect or affection for you. I wish never to meet you again." Once again, Hattie had succumbed to pressure from her father, who vowed that he would never receive McClure as his son-in-law, and that if Hattie chose to marry him, he would never be allowed into the house. Everything about McClure was anathema to Professor Hurd, who objected to his personal appearance, his bearing, his address, adding for good measure that he found Sam conceited, impertinent, meddlesome. In sum, he concluded, "I regard it as a misfortune that you ever made his acquaintance." Forced to choose between her father and Sam, Hattie could not betray her father. Unaware of the reception that awaited him, McClure knocked on the door where Hattie was staying. Told that she did not wish to see him, he refused to leave the parlor until she finally came down. "I do not love you," she said flatly, adding icily, "and I never can. Please be good enough to return to me any of my letters that you may still have." This dismissal, McClure recounted later, "I accepted as final." With no definite plans and no place to stay, he took a train to Boston, where the offices of the Pope Manufacturing Company were located. This company had recently produced a newfangled sensation with the Columbia Roadster, America's first bicycle. The owner, Colonel Albert Pope, had purchased advertising space in McClure's student publication, furnishing McClure with an opening to meet the entrepreneur. Finding McClure's enthusiasm and determination irresistible, Pope put him in charge of the bicycle rink where beginners came to learn how to ride. Though McClure himself had never ridden a bicycle, he was soon teaching others to operate the unwieldy contraption with a high front wheel nearly twice the size of its rear wheel. When Pope revealed to McClure his determination to publish a magazine devoted to bicycling, fire was touched to kindling. On the basis of his experience at the Knox Student, McClure convinced Pope that he could edit the magazine Pope envisioned, to weave the bicycle into the best in literature and art. Just at this time, McClure received a fortuitous letter from his friend, John Phillips, who was struggling to plot his own future career. "You are the surest fellow I ever saw," Phillips wrote McClure. "You always alight on your feet. I wish I had one half your push and business ability. Great heavens, I wish I was with you. If you think I can make a living, I'll come." So Phillips joined McClure as co-editor of The Wheel Man, as the surprisingly professional illustrated monthly magazine was titled. Reviews of the new magazine, which included short stories, articles, and book reviews, were positive. The Nation rated it among the most attractive of the monthly magazines. While Phillips ran the office, McClure took to the road, hopeful to persuade New England writers such as Oliver Wendell Holmes, Harriet Prescott Spofford, and Thomas Bailey Aldrich to barter articles for a new bicycle. "I was in the big game, in the real business of the world," McClure recalled. "Up to this time, I had always lived in the future and felt that I was simply getting ready for something. Now, I began to live in the present." Wheelman was the first professional enterprise into which McClure poured his astounding energy. Ascending the steps to that office at 597 Washington Street, he bid a final farewell to his youthful self. "When I have passed that place in later years," he strangely recalled in his autobiography, "I have fairly seen him standing there, a thin boy with a face somewhat worn from loneliness and wanting things he couldn't get, a little hurt at being left so unceremoniously. When I went up the steps, he stopped outside, and now it seems to me that I stopped on the steps and looked at him, and that when he looked at me, I turned and never spoke to him and went into the building. I came out with a job, but I never saw him again. And now, I have no sense of identity with that boy." McClure had not seen Hattie since the brutal rejection he had suffered. Then, as he busily worked to produce Wheelman in the fall, she reached out to him, insisting that she had deceived him because she simply could not bring herself to disobey her father. "I felt that you would take nothing as a reason for our separation," she endeavored to explain, "as long as you believed that I loved you. And so I gave you, falsely, the only reason that I knew would be valid in your eyes. I perjured myself. I loved you then, and love you still." In September 1883, they were quietly married, with John Phillips serving as McClure's best man. Sam and Hattie began their married life in Boston, but only 3 months later, when Sam was offered a position as an editorial assistant with the prestigious Century magazine, they moved to New York. The following summer, after the birth of the first of his four children, Sam found himself increasingly restless in his new job. He yearned for independent control of some venture, and finally hit upon an idea he shared with the editor of the Century. He proposed that the Century underwrite a literary associated press, a syndicate that would purchase stories and articles from well-known authors and then sell them at reduced rates to numerous newspapers for simultaneous publication, usually in their new Sunday supplements. "I saw it, in all its ramifications, as completely as I ever did afterward," McClure later explained, "and I don't think I ever added anything to my first conception." Century editor Roswell Smith liked the idea, but thought it unsuitable for the magazine. He offered McClure a month's vacation with full pay to see if he could launch the project on his own, with the opportunity to return to the Century should the venture fail. In a matter of weeks, McClure's syndicate was up and running. His first sale was a short story by the popular writer Hjalmar H. Boyesen, which he bought for $150 and promptly sold to a sufficient number of newspapers to make a handsome profit. He then utilized the proceeds to send 1,000 circulars to editors across the nation. This flyer explained how 12 or 20 or 50 newspapers, selected so as to avoid conflict in circulation, can thus secure a story for a sum which will be very small for each paper, but which will, in the aggregate, be sufficiently large to secure the best work by the best authors. The syndicate grew so steadily that by 1887, As biographer Peter Lyon estimates, McClure was distributing 50,000 words a week to well over 100 newspapers. Phillips, after 3 years in graduate school, first at Harvard and then in Leipzig, Germany, once again joined his friend and assumed responsibility for the daily management of the syndicate, a role for which he was much better fitted than McClure. "He had an orderly and organized mind, which I had not," McClure acknowledged. "I usually lost interest in a scheme as soon as it was started, and had no power of developing a plan and carrying it out to its least detail, as Mr. Phillips had." With his trusted friend at the helm, McClure was free to travel from one end of the country to the other, and eventually from one end of Europe to the other, always seeking new material, and always, like the retriever, coming back with a treasure trove in his teeth. "McClure was a Columbus among editors," proclaimed the writer and critic Jeanette L. Gilder. "I doubt if there is any man in his profession who has to his credit the discovery of more big writers." At the time, three principal literary journals, Century, Atlantic, and Harper's, had a stranglehold on America's literary market. They were defenders of everything dignified and conservative in the magazine world. Young writers, particularly those who embraced the new realistic style, scorned by established critics, had difficulty publishing their stories. McClure gave them a chance. "My qualifications for being an editor," McClure explained, "were that I was open-minded, naturally enthusiastic, and not afraid to experiment with a new man." McClure, who had adopted the designation SS rather than Sam, is credited with introducing Robert Louis Stevenson, Rudyard Kipling, James Matthew Barrie, and A. Conan Doyle to American readers. "He secured the best writers in the world," one reviewer noted. "He had the discernment in some cases and the good luck in others to establish connections with rising authors at the happy moment when they were about to step across the threshold of fame. He helped them and they helped him. His treatment of them was both honorable and generous." McClure noted proudly that he had purchased Kipling's work before the name of Kipling had been printed in a newspaper in this country. After reading one of Doyle's short stories, McClure promptly purchased a dozen Sherlock Holmes mysteries at the bargain price of $60 apiece. "To find the best authors," he boasted, "is like being able to tell good wine without the labels." The McClure Syndicate serialized The Quality of Mercy, a novel by the controversial champion of realism, William Dean Howells. They printed stories by Thomas Hardy and Emile Zola, which shocked genteel readers, and published a series of polemics by William Morris on socialism, Hamlin Garland on wheat farmers, and Henry Harland on life in the slums of the Jewish East Side. Even as he provided a platform for new voices and radical topics, McClure filled the preponderance of his pages with stories and poems from established writers, and more staid articles on standard subjects of interest, religion, adventure, travel, Abraham Lincoln, and the Civil War. By the early 1890s, the success of the McClure Syndicate was assured. "I propose to down all competition, and in a short time I can dominate the world in my line," he bragged headily. "My blood is like champagne." Such unqualified success, however, seemed a harbinger to the restlessness that had plagued him since childhood, the compulsive drive to stave off depression through ceaseless activity. He felt compelled to tackle something new, lest depression, always waiting in the wings, resume center stage. In 1892, he and Phillips began discussing the creation of a new, low-priced, high-quality illustrated magazine. "I would rather edit a magazine," McClure told Hattie, "than be president of the United States 100,000 times over." Conventional wisdom held that 35 cents was the lowest price a publisher of a quality magazine could charge and still anticipate a reasonable profit. At 35 cents, a magazine was necessarily targeted to the moneyed and well-educated classes, a parameter which kept the contents leisurely in habit, literary in tone, retrospective rather than timely, and friendly to the interests of the upper classes. McClure's resolve to put a quality magazine within the reach of all who care about good literature at 15 cents per copy was tantamount to revolution. New technology made his rash endeavor to compete with publications like the Century or the Atlantic feasible. The impregnability of the older magazines, McClure explained, was largely due to the costliness of wood engraving. Only an established publication with a large working capital could afford illustrations made by that process. Photo engraving was the innovation that fundamentally altered the printing industry. At a fraction of the cost of wood engraving, the new process allowed publishers to make pictures directly from photographs, which were cheap, instead of from drawings, which were expensive. McClure envisioned a new magazine containing four sections. The Edge of the Future would feature interviews in which scientists, such as Thomas Edison or Alexander Graham Bell, discussed their recent inventions. Human Documents would showcase portraits of famous people at different ages. The Real Conversations would present one distinguished person interviewing another. And the final section would offer short stories initially drawn from the best fiction already published in the syndicate, thereby costing him almost nothing to reprint. McClure hoped to use syndicate profits to support the new magazine until it could stand on its own. One of his trips west to garner support for the magazine included a visit to Davenport, Iowa, where he reconnected with his Knox classmate Albert Brady and persuaded him to come on board as his advertising manager. In all his plans, however, McClure could not have anticipated the panic of 1893, the run on the banks, and the burgeoning unemployment that bankrupted some newspapers and forced others to slash expenses. In this climate, the syndicate became one of the first things struggling newspapers jettisoned. There was certainly never a more inopportune time to launch a new business, McClure lamented. McClure had little personal capital to invest in the venture, having paid syndicate authors handsomely and incurred heavy expenses searching out new world-class writers. He had built up an invaluable asset, however, the goodwill of thousands of people, friends, fellow editors, and writers. Phillips persuaded his father to place a mortgage on his Galesburg home, bringing in $4,500. Conan Doyle invested $5,000. Colonel Pope supplied $6,000, and the geologist Henry Drummond, whose articles would frequently appear in the new journal, invested $2,000 and volunteered a loan of $1,000. The first issue, appearing on the stands in June of 1893, received uniformly favorable reviews. It is not often that a new periodical begins its career with prestige enough to make its success a certainty from the very first number, noted the Review of Reviews. But the wisest judges conceded a place among the winners. The Providence Journal rated it no little of a triumph, applauding its freshness and originality. It is not an imitation of anything existing in this country. The Philadelphia Public Ledger placed it in the front rank at once, while the Atlanta Constitution hailed it unusually brilliant. From Theodore Roosevelt came a letter of congratulations on the first issue of your excellent magazine. McClure immediately understood that his magazine must have a unity beyond a mere compilation of freelance articles suiting the individual tastes of miscellaneous authors. He dreamed of creating a full-time staff of writers who would be guaranteed salary and generous expense accounts. The job of staff writer was a new concept. In years to come, McClure would claim he himself almost invented it, a justifiable assertion at a time when few magazines subsidized their writers. He wished a writing staff to collaborate with him and with each other, treating mutually agreed upon topics in line with the general attitude of the publication. He wanted to deal with important social, economic, and political questions, to present the new and great inventions and discoveries, to give the best in literature, and above all, to become a power in the land, a power for good. Indeed, the ultimate success of McClure's, its literary worth, its major contributions to progressive-era reforms, and significant role in the rise of Theodore Roosevelt and the downfall of Taft, can be directly traced to the prodigiously gifted writing staff McClure assembled. Along with the nucleus consisting of Ida Tarbell, Ray Stanyard Baker, Lincoln Steffens, and William Allen White, the McClure's staff intermittently included Burton Hendrick, Mark Sullivan, George Kibbe Turner, Will Irwin, Willa Cather, Stephen Crane, and Frank Norris. This talented pool of writers produced hundreds of influential pieces, which played a major role in shaping public discourse around the most pressing economic and social issues of the day. Ida Minerva Tarbell, the first to join McClure's stable of writers, became the mother hen of the group. The story of the first meeting between McClure and Tarbell in the summer of 1892 would be told and retold in the years ahead. McClure had briefly stopped in Paris on one of his whirlwind tours in search of material for his new magazine. 34 and unmarried, Tarbell had been living on the Left Bank for 12 months, struggling to support herself with freelance articles for American newspapers. Her free hours were spent in the manuscript room of the National Library, researching the life of Madame Roland, a celebrated figure in the French Revolution. One of her newspaper articles, The Paving of the Streets of Paris by Monsieur Alphand, had landed on McClure's desk. "This girl can write," McClure told Phillips. "I want to get her to do some work for the magazine." The piece, he later said, possessed exactly the qualities he desired. A clear narrative style, alive with human interest, sound judgment, and trustworthy facts. Tarbell was then lodging in a boarding house on an obscure, crooked street unknown to half the cochers of Paris. Yet somehow, McClure managed to locate the place one Monday evening, bareheaded, watch in hand, breathless, from racing up the 80 steps to her fourth floor of chamber. "I've just 10 minutes," he gasped. "Must leave for Switzerland tonight to see Tyndall." Those minutes stretched to nearly 3 hours, as McClure regaled her with childhood tales in Ireland, his struggles at Knox College and desperate pursuit of Hattie, his creation of the syndicate and friendship with Phillips. Finally, he laid out his plans for the new magazine and for her involvement in it. Captivated by his outrightness, his enthusiasm and confidence, Tarbell, in turn, confided her own experiences, her hopes and ambitions. Though less extreme than McClure's, Ida's history was shaped by an equally fierce resolution to succeed. The oldest of four children, she was born the same year as McClure and raised in northwestern Pennsylvania, where the discovery of oil had transformed wilderness areas into bustling cities and towns. Her father, Franklin Tarbell, was making more than he could ever have dreamed as an independent oil producer. Titusville, where Franklin built a substantial home for his growing family, was flourishing, confident of its future, boasting graded roads, handsome homes, college preparatory high schools, and a newly built opera house. Things were going well in father's business, Ida recalled. There was ease such as we had never known, luxuries we had never heard of. For the local oil men who drilled the wells and sustained a booming local economy, it seemed there was nothing they did not hope and dare. The triumph of optimism in Titusville was destined to end, however. Suddenly, at the very heyday of this confidence, a big hand reached out from nobody knew where to steal their conquest and throttle their future. That mysterious hand belonged to none other than John D. Rockefeller, as Tarbell would boldly elucidate years later in her chronicle of the history of the Standard Oil Company for McClure's magazine, the landmark series that would affirm her reputation as the leading investigative journalist of her day. At the time, however, all that Ida's father and his colleagues knew was that the railroads arbitrarily doubled their published rates for carrying petroleum, crude and refined, to the East Coast, a huge inflation heralding ruin for the entire region. The local oil men eventually discovered that Rockefeller had forged an alliance between the railroads and a small group of privileged refiners. His big scheme enabled those in the newly formed South Improvement Company to receive secret rebates on every barrel shipped, while outside companies would be charged increased rates to make up for the insider's discount. This deal, meant to destroy small competitors, Tarbell later explained, started the Standard Oil Company off on the road to monopoly. The local producers joined together to retaliate. There were nightly anti-monopoly meetings, Ida recalled, violent speeches, processions. Trains of oil cars loaded for members of the offending corporation were raided, the oil run on the ground. The tension of these confrontations were reflected in the Tarbell household. Franklin Tarbell no longer entertained his family with the funny things he had seen and heard during the day, or relaxed with an after-dinner cigar to the music he loved. If the machinations behind the conflict were all pretty hazy to young Ida, she gleaned enough from her father's conversation to comprehend that what had been undertaken was wrong. From that painful, disruptive period, she wrote, there was born in me a hatred of privilege. In this case, the powerful oil men preying on the independents, but eventually, privilege of any sort. While her father fought against monopoly, her mother struggled with a painful readjustment of her status in the home and in society. Esther Tarbell, Ida later wrote, had grown up with the woman's rights movement. She had taught for a dozen years before her marriage and had planned on seeking a higher education. Had she remained single, Ida believed, she would have sought to vindicate her sex. The fight would have delighted her. After marriage, however, she found herself a pioneer in the oil region, confronted by the sternest of problems, which compelled the investment of her energies into the well-being of her family. Witnessing her mother's frustration, Ida determined early on that she would never marry. She was certain that having a husband and children would thwart her freedom and curtail her nascent ambition. At 14, she fell to her knees and entreated God to prevent her ever marrying. Captivated by the natural world, Ida had spent the long afternoons of her childhood wandering around the countryside to gather leaves and plant specimens in her area, classifying them by shapes, veins, stalks, color. She began her high school years already intent upon a career as a biologist. Graduating at the top of her class at Titusville High, she enrolled in Allegheny College in Meadville, Pennsylvania, in the fall of 1876, the same year that Roosevelt matriculated at Harvard. At 18, Ida had reached her full height of 5 feet 10 inches. She was not considered pretty. Her nose and ears were too big, but her luminous eyes indicated unusual sensitivity and intelligence. As the sole woman in the freshman class, and one of 4 in the entire college, she felt herself an invader. In the college library, however, she found the companionship there is in the silent presence of books. Though she may have been shy and immature, Ida was a tenacious student, and she had the good fortune of studying under a great natural teacher, Jeremiah Tingley, the chair of the science department. Like Professor Hurd, Tingley had studied under Louis Agassiz and absorbed the celebrated scientist's faith in observation and classification, as well as his reverence for nature. Sensing Ida's enthusiasm and native intelligence, he took particular interest in her progress. Coupled with her own fierce drive, this support helped her excel once again. She would arise at 4 a.m. and get to work studying, a classmate recalled. She was never satisfied with anything less than perfection. But she was no grind. She was too interested in people. After graduation, Ida taught for 2 years at Poland Union Seminary in Poland, Ohio, hoping to save enough money to go abroad and study with some great biologist. Her wages were low, however, and 2 years later she had managed to save nothing to further her dream of studying in Europe. She returned to Meadville, where she took a temporary job annotating articles for the Chautauquan, the official publication of the recently founded Chautauqua Institution, a summer camp that provided Bible studies and lectures on science, the arts, and humanities. What began as a temporary assignment became a full-time job as she rose to become managing editor of the Chautauquan, discovering in the process a great fascination with storytelling and the delineation of character. My early absorption in rocks and plants had veered to as intense an interest in human beings, she reported. I was feeling the same passion to understand men and women, the same eagerness to collect and classify information about them. I recognized that men and women were as well worth notes as leaves, that there was a science of society as well as of botany. She and her colleagues on the Liberal Monthly magazine were ardent supporters of the inclusive labor organization, the Knights of Labor, and their fight for an 8-hour workday. We discussed interminably the growing problem of the slums, were particularly strong for cooperative housing, laundries, and bake shops, she recalled. She came to the conclusion that a trilogy of wrongs was responsible for the maldistribution of wealth. Discriminatory transportation rates, tariffs, save for revenue only, and private ownership of natural resources. My life was busy, varied, unfolding pleasantly in many ways, but it also, after 6 years, was increasingly unsatisfactory, she later wrote. I was trapped. Comfortably, most pleasantly, most securely, but trapped. While she stayed up nights working out several ideas for a novel, her days were occupied with the myriad demands of editing the magazine. Furthermore, the design she had brought to the disorderly fashion in which the editor-in-chief, Dr. Theodore L. Flood, had formerly managed the magazine, was never truly credited. Inevitably, she found herself secretly, very secretly, meditating a change. She envisioned herself in Paris, researching and writing a biography of Madame Roland, an alluring character she had included in a series of sketches for the Chautauquan on women of the French Revolution. Though she still had little money saved, Ida aspired to earn a living writing articles on Parisian life for several of the newspaper syndicates in the United States. Dr. Flood was stunned when Ida revealed that she was leaving for Paris. "How will you support yourself?" he demanded. When she replied that she would make her own way by writing, his retort was memorably cruel and condescending. "You're not a writer," he announced. "You'll starve." Though Flood struck deep-seated anxieties about her vocation as a writer, she would not be deterred. She persuaded two of her friends from the Chautauquan to join her, and the threesome set sail for Europe in August of 1891. After searching several days for affordable lodgings, they found a boarding house in the Latin Quarter run by Madame Bonnet, a cheerful, welcoming landlady. Though their rooms were tiny, they shared a salon with an amiable group of Egyptian students. Before long, they had developed close friendships. Ida set to work immediately, outlining a series of articles on the daily life of Paris. She astutely guessed that people back home would want to know the very things she herself was curious about: what Parisians did for entertainment, what they ate and drank, how the city preserved the beauty of its parks and sidewalks, whether it was safe for women to walk the streets at night. For an article on the poor, she worked for a time in a soup kitchen. She haunted the shops in the Jewish section for a story on Parisian Jews. "There were a multitude of things I thirsted to know," Ida wrote, "and if I could get my bread and butter finding out, what luck! What luck!" "There were few mornings that I was not at my desk at 8 o'clock," she remembered. "There were few nights when I went to bed before midnight, and there was real drudgery in making legible copy after my article was written." On weekends, she allowed time for expeditions to the cathedrals and the museums, to Versailles and Fontainebleau. Before 7 weeks had passed, she had sent a dozen articles to various papers at home, but had heard nothing in return. It seemed as if Flood's prediction would prove correct. Finally, in early November, she received her first check from the Cincinnati Times-Star, the paper edited by Will Taft's brother, Charles. "It was not much. $6, she reported to her family. How the doctor would scorn it. But I was glad to get it, because it's a start." In the meantime, she and her friends managed to enjoy their bohemian poverty. They dined two nights a week with Madame Bonnet, who provided a good dinner of 6 courses with cider and wine for 40 cents. "These were happy evenings," Ida recalled, "for the Egyptians loved games, tricks, charades, play of any sort. They found a local restaurant that catered to Americans and offered a noonday meal for 23 cents. Think of us," she wrote home, "going into a place where there is sawdust on the floor, a bar in one corner, every table with wine and many men smoking cigarettes, but there are lots of ladies, American artists, and then everybody does it." For their remaining meals, they pledged to spend only 12 cents to offset the expense of the dinners, buying not a morsel more than they absolutely required: a single egg, 1 roll or croissant, a gill of milk, 2 cups apiece of café au lait, never having a drop left in the pot. Winter came early to Paris that year. "It is the most heartless weather I ever experienced," she informed her family. "It is clear and dry, but the wind cuts like a knife." With only one little heating grate in the room where she wrote, she sat at her desk with one shawl wrapped around her legs, another over her head, and a hand stove to keep her feet warm. At night, she wore everything but her sealskin coat to bed. Still, she was convinced that no one in Paris was having more fun. "It isn't money, after all, that makes the best of things," she assured them. A breakthrough came in December when Scribner's accepted a piece of short fiction pending her agreement on several changes. "I think after mature deliberation for about 1/50th of a second that I'll allow the changes to be made," she excitedly told her parents. "That it has been accepted at all is a tremendous encouragement to me. It gives me heart and hope." Scribner's paid $100 for the story, nearly the amount she had brought to cover her passage to Europe and her first months in Paris. What excitement in our little salon when I showed my companions that check! Her success freed her to attend courses at the Sorbonne on French history and literature, and spend time at the library going through the papers of Madame Roland, relax with friends in the cafes, and buy a new pair of shoes. In the months that followed, more and more newspapers accepted her articles. Writing $5 and $10 articles was admittedly an awful slow way of making one's living, but Ida had proved Dr. Flood wrong and banished her own doubts. She was a working woman, living in a city she adored, surviving on her own as a published writer. McClure's invitation to join him as he launched his new magazine intrigued Ida, but she was unwilling to leave for New York before her research on Madame Roland was complete. She happily agreed, however, to contribute freelance articles from Paris once the magazine was underway. His mission that summer evening in 1892 accomplished, McClure suddenly jumped to his feet. "I must go," he said. "Could you lend me $40? It is too late to get money over town, and I must catch the train for Geneva." As it happened, Ida had exactly that sum stashed in a drawer saved for a long-awaited vacation. "It never occurred to me to do anything but give it to him," she recalled, though the next day she suffered some bad moments, fearing he would simply never think of it again. The following day, a $40 check was sent from McClure's office in London. Work for the new magazine opened up a broad new world of intellectual adventure. She studied microbe theory and interviewed Louis Pasteur in his home, examined the psychology of legerdemain, investigated the new Bertillon system of criminal identification, surveyed public health practices in French cities, and secured contributions from Émile Zola, Alphonse Daudet, and Alexandre Dumas. McClure was thrilled with her work. "We all hope you are not planning to get married and cut short your career," he told her. "All of the articles which you have sent us recently are most admirably done. I have always liked your work, as you know, but of late you have been surpassing yourself." The only snag in this propitious arrangement was that McClure had no money to compensate her efforts. Despite rave reviews, the new magazine was struggling to survive in the midst of the severe depression. Indeed, the situation was so bleak, Esther Tarbell informed her daughter, that people were actually starving by hundreds and thousands. The alarming circumstances had convinced her mother that monopolies are fearful evils, a plague to confront by peaceful means or by force if it must be. Irrepressible Ida, on the ragged edge of bankruptcy, nonetheless insisted she was gay as a cricket. She continued to believe in McClure. "The little magazine is sure to live," she assured her family. "They are honest and energetic and young, and they'll pull through." Her prediction proved on the mark. Month by month, McClure's circulation continued to increase. In April, McClure returned to Paris, this time securing Ida's commitment to begin full-time work on the magazine in the fall. First, however, she would spend the summer with her parents in Titusville, where she hoped to complete her book on Madame Roland. Tarbell had been home for only 6 weeks when she received an urgent wire from McClure beseeching her to come to New York. An intense fascination with Napoleon Bonaparte had recently swept Europe, and McClure believed that America, too, would be captivated anew by the French emperor. McClure had made connection with Gardner Green Hubbard, father-in-law to Alexander Graham Bell, and owner of a valuable collection of Napoleon portraits. McClure secured Hubbard's permission to reproduce the portraits alongside a short biography of Napoleon by the English author Robert Sherard. The illustrated series, set to begin in November, had been heavily promoted. When the manuscript arrived, Hubbard found the tone so contemptuously anti-Napoleon that he withdrew permission to let his pictures accompany the text. In desperation, McClure turned to Ida. Though the task of producing the first installment in 6 weeks seemed impossible, Ida agreed to try. She left at once for Washington, where she was given a suite in Hubbard's magnificent country estate on Woodley Lane, not far from Roosevelt's modest DuPont Circle home. In addition to Hubbard's immense library, she had access to the State Department archives, which held printed copies of all Napoleon's official correspondence. Granted a desk at the Library of Congress, Tarbell was able to summon books and pamphlets from what turned out to be an exceptional collection covering the Napoleonic era. Despite embarrassment that she was constructing a biography on the gallop, Ida not only met the deadline but produced a work of quality. When the 7 installments were completed, the New York Press hailed the series as the best short life of Napoleon we have ever seen. From the reigning Napoleon expert came the welcome, heartening comment, "I have often wished that I had had, as you did, the prod of necessity behind me, the obligation to get it out at a fixed time, to put it through, no time to idle, to weigh, only to set down. You got something that way, a living sketch." An additional benefit of her accomplishment was Scribner's agreement to publish her book on Madame Roland. On the strength of the Napoleon series, the circulation of McClure's doubled, reaching nearly 100,000 by publication of the final installment. Even before it was finished, McClure conjured another series for Tarbell, A Short Life of Abraham Lincoln. His insight told him that people never had had enough of Lincoln, explained Tarbell, and he was certain that 30 years after Lincoln's death, hundreds of people remained whose reminiscences were still untapped. Characteristically, once having conceived the project, McClure could think of nothing but Lincoln morning, noon, and night. "Out with you," he ordered Tarbell. "Look, see, report." Before her departure, Ida called on John Nicolay, whose monumental biography had recently been serialized in the Century. Nicolay greeted her coldly. He assured her that he and co-author John Hay had discovered all there was worth telling of Lincoln's life. She would be well advised not to touch so hopeless an assignment. When the Century's editor, Richard Watson Gilder, was questioned about his opinion of McClure's magazine, he scoffed, "They got a girl to write a life of Lincoln." Nicolay's disdain influenced her plan of campaign. Rather than start her inquiry at the end of the story with the great and known, she would begin in Kentucky with the humble and unknown. She would trace Lincoln's life chronologically through the little towns and settlements where he had lived and worked. Her approach unearthed scores of people who had known him in those early days. She scoured local histories, probed court records and newspaper clippings. Combining the skills of an investigative reporter with those of a detective, artist, and biographer, she coaxed reluctant people and jogged their memories with the hard evidence she had discovered. McClure covered all her expenses and kept her on salary during the 3-year period of her research and writing. She completed her project in a charming Washington boarding house on I Street between 9th and 10th, a lodging shared by Massachusetts Senator and Mrs. Hoar. McClure scrutinized multiple drafts of every installment, assuring that the narrative retained its momentum. The series proved a popular and critical triumph. "It is not only full of new things," the Chicago Tribune wrote, "but is so distinct and clear in local color that an interest attaches to it which is not found in other biographies." When the first installment appeared, McClure's circulation increased by 40,000 copies to 190,000. A month later, it reached 250,000, exceeding both the Century and Harper's Monthly. With the completion of the Lincoln series, McClure brought Tarbell to New York as the desk editor of the magazine. The publication was then housed on the 6th floor of the Lexington Building on 25th Street. Working in the office each day, Tarbell soon understood the critical role that John S. Phillips, whom they called JSP, played in the success of the magazine. If McClure was the wind in the sails, with great power to stir excitement by his suggestions, his endless searching after something new, alive, startling, The stabilizing ballast was the steady, unflappable Phillips. "Here's a man," Tarbell wrote, "who knows the power of patience in dealing with the impatient." Phillips lived in the city during the week so that he could be available day and night. On weekends, he joined his wife, Jenny, and their small children in Goshen, New York, a small town in the foothills of the Catskills. It was said in the office that Sam had 300 ideas a minute, but only JSP knew which one was not crazy. "I found the place so warmly and often ridiculously human," Tarbell remembered. Her genial temperament allowed her to get on capitally with the brilliant but volatile art director August Jakacci, whose towering fits of anger came and went like terrible summer thundershowers. She developed a lifelong friendship with Viola Roseborough, the cigarette-smoking, wisecracking former actress in charge of reading the thousands of unsolicited manuscripts that arrived month after month. Without doubt, Ida was enamored with McClure himself. Years later, she remembered how his blue eyes glowed and sparkled when the peripatetic publisher prowled the newsroom, spouting a tumult of thoughts and projects, any one of which might harbor a stroke of genius. For Ida Tarbell, the most alluring aspect of McClure's was the sense of vitality, of adventure, of excitement. The feeling of being admitted on terms of equality and good comradeship with an extraordinary group of people. They perched on one another's desks. They lunched together at the Ashland House. They drank together after hours. Each was an integral component of a team that was creating what would soon become the most exciting and influential magazine the country had ever seen. The next permanent acquisition to join Ida Tarbell on McClure's writing staff was Ray Stanyard Baker. Baker had spent 6 years reporting for the Chicago Record, a publication he proudly called an honest paper that played no inside game but wanted to tell the truth, whatever it might be. His distinguished work at the Record included an extensive and memorable series on the growing tension between labor and capital. Baker had always enjoyed talking with farmers, tinkers, blacksmiths, news dealers, bootblacks, and the like, and firmly believed that every human being has a story in him. How he has come to be what he is, how he manages, after all, to live, just to live. At the age of 27, however, Baker felt he had exhausted the possibilities of the newspaper format. He craved a wider field of activity, a vehicle for in-depth research, a space for longer stories of lasting import and value. An avid reader of McClure's from its inception, he had quickly become a devoted admirer. The magazine's long and thoroughly researched articles, he noted with admiration, were not merely about people. The people seemed to be there in person, alive, and talking. The innovative publication, in his opinion, was simply something fresh and strong and living in a stodgy literary world. After reading Tarbell's series on Lincoln, Baker sent McClure's a proposal for an article on his uncle, Colonel Lafayette C. Baker, the Secret Service member, who had led the party that captured John Wilkes Booth. Tarbell promised to give it serious attention, and within days of its arrival, the piece was accepted for immediate publication. Intuiting that Baker might be a good fit for the magazine, McClure suggested that he come to New York and discuss ideas for further contributions. To say that I was awed at having a letter from the founder and editor of such a magazine was to put it mildly, Baker related a half-century later. Soon he received a letter from John S. Phillips with an enclosed pass on the New York Central Railroad. "It took my breath away," he remembered. "So this is the magical way they did things in New York." Of that first foray into New York, he related that Mr. McClure had suddenly dashed off to Europe, as was his custom, but I had long and delightful talks with John Phillips and August Jakacci, the art director, and Ida Tarbell, and others of the staff. I went out with them to the jolly table at the old Ashland House, where they lunched together, a spot that still glimmers bright in my memory. It all seemed like a marvelous new world, with a quality of enthusiasm and intellectual interest I had never before encountered. Even with S.S. McClure absent, I suppose I was in the most stimulating, yes, intoxicating, editorial atmosphere then existent in America, or anywhere else. In the months that followed, Baker submitted half a dozen additional articles to McClure's while continuing to work at the Chicago Record. When the coveted invitation to join the McClure staff finally arrived, he accepted at once, though he would miss his cohorts at the Record. "It breaks me all up to leave after having been so long and so intimately connected with the paper," he told his father. "I suppose the regret is natural and that it will wear off as I bend to other work. I hope so." Once in New York, he never looked back. "This is a magnificent old town," he assured his father. "I never worked so hard in my life as I am doing now." He got on exceedingly well with the entire McClure staff. "I like them, and they like me," he proudly noted. "Baker was a capital team worker," Tarbell recalled. "He had curiosity, appreciation, a respect for facts. You could not ruffle or antagonize him. He took the sudden calls to go here when he was going there with equanimity. He enjoyed the unconventional intimacies of the crowd, the gaiety and excitement of belonging to what was more and more obviously a success. He was the least talkative of us all, observant rather than garrulous, the best listener in the group, save Mr. Phillips. He had a joyous laugh which was more revealing of his healthy inner self than anything else about him." Baker's cheerful, balanced temperament could likely be traced to a devoted father and a peaceful childhood in the frontier village of St. Croix, Wisconsin. The oldest of six sons, he shared his father's love for fishing and hunting amidst the forests and the swift rivers and the lumber camps. Joseph Stanyard Baker, his father, had been educated at Oberlin and the University of Wisconsin. An honored member of the Secret Service during the Civil War, he married Alice Potter, a minister's daughter from Lansing, and became the resident agent of a timber-rich swath of Wisconsin territory owned by absentee landlords. "Ours was a house of books," Baker fondly recalled, noting with pride that his father's library was the largest in the entire county. Every night, Stanyard Baker would read aloud to his boys. "How well I remember the little gatherings just before bedtime," Ray later wrote. "The lamp in the middle of the table, the book, whatever it was, open before him and the small audience, tousle-headed with grimy legs drawn up under them, sitting with mouths open and eyes fixed upon the reader's face. Whatever Father did, he did with gusto." "Stanyard's animation and expressive voice," wrote Ray, "made him a prodigious storyteller, the best I ever knew. We teased incessantly for stories, and it was not unusual in the earlier days for my father to have a room full of people for his audience." Ray was still a child when his father gave him a silver dollar for completing Pilgrim's Progress. No further bribery was ever required to fuel his passion for all manner of tales. By the time he was 11, he loved nothing more than entering into the lives and sorrows and joys of others through books. "My reading was always a kind of living," he explained, "a longing to know some man or men stronger, braver, wiser, wittier, more amusing, more desperately wicked than I was, whom I could come to know well and sometimes be friends with." The eldest child and his father's favorite, Ray was expected to help shape the behavior of his younger siblings. Both in the classroom and at home, he strove to be worthy of that trust. He was the top student in his grammar school class, performed household chores without complaint, and diligently participated in Sunday school classes. When his mother's ill health briefly forced her into a sanitarium, Ray assumed responsibility for provisioning the household with food and supplies. For a time after her return, her condition seemed to improve, but the year Ray turned 13, Alice Baker died. Ray would never forget the shock of witnessing his father's grief. "It went through me like the thrust of a sharp knife. It was more terrible than anything else that had happened. My father, that strong man, that refuge of safety and fearlessness, my father, shaken with weeping." After only 1 year in high school, Ray passed the entrance examinations for college, allowing him to enter Michigan Agricultural College, later Michigan State, as a 15-year-old freshman. Like Ida Tarbell, Ray enjoyed the invaluable benefit of an inspired botany professor, William Beale, yet another acolyte, like Professor Hurd and Tingley, of Harvard's Louis Agassiz. Ray's first experience in Professor Beale's laboratory made an indelible impression. Instructed to study a single plant specimen for several days under a compound microscope, he initially deemed the assignment a great waste of time when he could simply research the specimen in a botany text and enumerate its characteristics. Baker soon came to understand that Beale wanted his students to learn by investigating for themselves, by compiling details and facts before principles and conclusions. Beale, he would come to realize, taught the one thing I needed most of all to know. This was to look at life before I talked about it. Not to look at it secondhand, by way of books, but so far as possible to examine the thing itself. The friendship he developed with his professor and mentor would last a lifetime. Indeed, Baker would eventually marry Beale's daughter, Jessie. And Beale's methodology would serve as Baker's lodestar throughout his long journalistic career. The personable Baker was well-liked in college. He stood 5 feet 10 inches tall, with handsome features, blue eyes behind round spectacles, a straight nose, and a cleft chin. The intense scholarship that kept him at the top of his class did not preclude joining a fraternity, playing rugby, or serving as editor-in-chief of the school newspaper. He was a leader in student government and was selected to deliver one of the commencement orations. That his father hoped he would return to St. Croix after college, learn the land business, and ultimately become his partner was long understood. "When the time comes, I shall give you advice," his father told him, "but I shall never attempt to force or urge you into any position or calling which is at all distasteful to you." Tears filled young Baker's eyes as he read those words, and he resolved never to fail his beloved father. Upon graduation, he dutifully returned home to apprentice in Stanyard's office. He soon discovered, however, that he was not adapted to a business life. He traveled with his father, keeping the books and bank accounts, but did not live in it, as one must do if he is to be happy and truly successful in any employment. Despite his efforts, he found his occupation increasingly distasteful. "I felt as though I were being crowded back into a kind of cocoon from which I had long ago worked free and flown." Ray consoled himself by writing poems and stories, and by recording thoughts in a journal, a habit he continued all his life. Decades later, he wrote of the tremendous importance this private chronicle held for him. "Experience soon fades. Thought degenerates into musing. Even love may presently wither. But the honestly written expression, hot from the penpoint, of the contents of one's mind, its observations, desires, doubts, faith, ambition, and the like, becomes, at length, a kind of immortality." Ray endured 2 cheerless years in the office, until his brother Harry, who found the land business far more congenial, replaced him. Harry's decision to join their father freed Ray to continue his education. Enrolling in the University of Michigan Law School in Ann Arbor, Ray soon found himself drawn instead to courses in the English department. A gifted professor, Fred Newton Scott, became his mentor. Unlike traditional surveys of the literary canon, Scott's seminar focused on a limited number of writers, subjecting their works to in-depth literary criticism. The progressive young professor believed, as did Howells and the realist school, that authors had a social responsibility to address the problems of their era. "The test of a writer's work," he told his students, "must be its contribution to the good working order of society as a whole." Baker signed up for a second seminar with Scott called Rapid Writing, one of the country's earliest college programs to teach journalism. The popular class required that students pick one newspaper to follow daily and focus on a particular subject. Baker chose the Chicago Record, concentrating on the struggles between laboring men and employers in that city. Immersed in coverage of the fight to establish workers' rights in the new industrial order, he began to question the laissez-faire economic principles inherited from his Republican father. Though he previously had read Henry George's Progress and Poverty, the book's remedy, a single tax on land, was anathema to his father, whose very livelihood was founded upon the ownership of land. Ray was still trying to reconcile these conflicting ideas when he encountered Professor Scott. Numerous stories in the Chicago Record that semester reflected growing tension between labor and capital, as well as an economic stagnation that signaled the impending depression of 1893. Every morning, Ray read and analyzed news articles and editorials, writing his own reports with the greatest fervor, eagerly anticipating Scott's exacting appraisals. "For the first time in my life, I was getting honest and direct criticism," he recalled, "and it was like a draft of clear water to a thirsty spirit." By the semester's close, Baker realized that his desire to study law had evaporated, and he was certain his future lay in journalism. "I did not make this breakaway without many hesitations," he admitted. "I knew how disappointed my father would be." Unable to confront Stanyard, he set out for Chicago, ostensibly seeking summer employment as a reporter, though in actuality he already hoped to make journalism his career. When he presented himself to the editor of the Chicago Record, Ray was told that there were no regular openings, but that he could await possible assignments in the city room. After many weeks, his opportunity arrived. The regular labor reporter was out on a story one afternoon when word came that the waiters in a popular restaurant had gone out on strike. Baker received the assignment. When he turned the article in, the assistant night editor delivered words he would never forget. "Great stuff, Baker," he exclaimed. "Great stuff." With bolstered confidence, Ray canvassed the neighborhoods of Chicago. His explorations resulted in a series of human interest stories, glimpses, street scenes, common little incidents of the daily life of a great city, which could be treated more or less lightly or humorously. Pleased with Baker's work, the Record offered him a regular position that fall. In December, however, he received an urgent summons from his father. Stanyard's hearing, damaged in the war many years earlier, was deteriorating into deafness. It was Harry's turn to enroll in college courses, and he needed his oldest son to come home. Ray tried to convince his father that his aspirations as a writer were neither pretentious nor frivolous, but his father's needs prevailed, and Ray found himself back in St. Croix. For nearly a year, he remained to assist his father until Harry's winter break allowed a return to Chicago. The Depression was taking a grim toll on the city that winter. Baker was welcomed back to the Record to cover the plight of the unemployed. "There are thousands of homeless and starving men in the streets," he told his father. "I have seen more misery in this last week than I ever saw in my life before." This destitute urban population was unlike anything he had encountered. While there were plenty of people on the frontier who were poor, he noted, they had means of subsistence. Land was to be had almost for the asking. Logs were at hand for their houses, all the streams were full of fish, and all the hills full of game. There was everywhere plenty of work. The city offered no such opportunities. The miserable living conditions, the long hours, the low wages, the universal insecurity, tended to tear down the personality, cheapen the man. As Harry prepared for the spring semester, Stanyard appealed once again to Ray. Ray had promised to return home in the event of absolute necessity to protect the family business. But leaving the newspaper would force him to begin all over again at the bottom of the ladder when he returned to Chicago. Moreover, he insisted, there is no use in trying to run a business with your heart elsewhere. While reluctant to return, he reassured his father of his loyalty. "I shall regard it as my first duty, whatever may happen, to see that your business is protected. And I think every one of the six boys feels in the same way." Realizing his son's devotion to his chosen vocation, Stanyard relented. Ray should remain in Chicago, and he would manage at home. Supplied with a typewriter for the first time, Ray was sent to Massillon, Ohio in mid-March of 1894 to cover a crusade that would become known as Coxey's Army. The fiery reformer Jacob Coxey planned a massive march on Washington to demand a government-sponsored public works program to put thousands of unemployed men to work building roads. Baker's first articles reflected his paper's editorial stance against the march, venting concern that a horde of vagrants and derelicts would wreak havoc as they marched through the countryside en route to the Capitol. As Baker trudged alongside the men, however, his attitude shifted. "I began to know some of them as Joe and Bill and George," he related. "I soon had them talking about their homes in Iowa and Colorado and Illinois and Chicago and Pittsburgh, and the real problems they had to meet. These were not bums, tramps, and vagabonds, but genuine farmers and working men, driven in a time of depression by their inability to earn a living." Baker's sympathetic articles brought hundreds of additional recruits to Coxey's army and revealed to him the incredible power of the press. Skeptics had predicted that the army, outfitted with supplies for only a few days, would soon disintegrate. At each scheduled stop, however, there appeared an impromptu local committee, sometimes including the mayor and other public men, with large supplies of bread, meat, milk, eggs, canned goods, coffee, tea. Following Coxey's improbable army was a grand adventure for Baker and his fellow correspondents.